Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at armorall.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It's the Autosport Podcast. We take a look at Fernando Alonso's successful test at Indy, preview the Spanish Grand Prix, and answer some reader questions. We have plenty to talk about this week with Fernando Alonso's first test at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, a look ahead to the Spanish Grand Prix, and even some Autosport Podcast listener questions for us to sort through for the first time. My name is Ed Straw, the Editor-in-Chief of Autosport. Joining me first is Kevin Turner, the Editor of Autosport Magazine. Now, Kev, you've taken time out from Autosport Press Day to join this podcast, so what's on the cover that you've just sent off to the printers this week?
Well, we're looking at the first four races of the F1 season so far to see what, you know, what have we learned. There was a lot of anticipation ahead of this season, new rules, a few new driver lineups. We're looking back to see what the first four races have told us. Obviously, Ferrari on a par with Mercedes, which is exciting for everyone. How Bottas is getting on, why Red Bull and McLaren are struggling, admittedly at different levels, but neither of them are doing what they want to, or arguably what they should be, and of course the midfield battle, which is really, really tight this year, which is easy to forget sometimes when you're looking at the front, but it's actually that's been pretty fascinating as well.
What else is there in there to read? Obviously it's not just contemporary F1.
No, we've also taken the opportunity to look back at some other world champions returning for one-off Grand Prix, obviously with Jenson Button coming back to McLaren for Monaco, because Fernando Alonso obviously will be at Indy. So we looked back at a few of those, and we've also, of course, had some big events at the weekend just gone. Toyota finished first and second at Spa in the World Endurance Championship, and we had quite a lot of drama at Thruxton in the British Touring Car round.
Well, plenty to read there then. That's out Thursday, and obviously you're obliged to buy the magazine if you're listening to this free podcast. Also joined by Scott Mitchell, the Autosport.com Plus editor. Now, Scott, you're preparing for a little bit of Formula E action in Monaco at the weekend. Obviously, there's been a bit of a gap again in the Formula E schedule, so can you electrify us and enlighten us on what we can expect at Monaco? Do you see what I did there?
That was absolutely terrible.
Seamless.
I'm off to Monaco this weekend. I'm really, really excited for that. It's Monaco has been on my personal bucket list for years and years and years. So it's not quite Formula One, but I'm happy to be going there for its sort of electric cousin.
Our first topic is Fernando Alonso, who will not be going to Monaco this year. He's going to be doing the Indy 500 at the end of the month. That adventure started with a test day at Indianapolis last week in the orange Andretti Autosport run Dallara Honda. It was an interesting experiment, I guess, in terms of the social media reach and the online reach, because you had 2 million or more than 2 million, in fact, viewers watching the feed of a guy having a test at an oval, which
including
is...
Including three people around this table, I assume.
Exactly, we were all keeping a very close eye on it. That's astonishing, really, isn't it? This story has massively captured the imagination, hasn't it? Why do we think that is?
Well, Alonso's a massive star to begin with, isn't he? He's been one of the best drivers in Formula One for over a decade, and he's been going through a patch where he hasn't been getting the results that he should have done. So I think there's a lot of people on his side. You know, if he'd been winning Grand Prix and World Championships, you know, people would be a bit more like, oh, you know. But because he's the underdog, there's a lot of interest there. And then he's going into the other world. You know, he's combining two worlds together in the F1. And the Indy 500 itself is massive. So you've got two pools of interest coming together. Both sides should be interested and fascinated by that story.
Maybe it's also down to the fact that that car's a proper orange, isn't it? It's a proper McLaren orange. I think Jenson Button said something about that, didn't he? He made a joke in the wake of the livery being announced, you know, because there was all the talk this year about the F1 car, you know, we're embracing the orange of McLaren's heritage, but it's not papaya, is it? It's kind of like a glossy
not
offset.
Not quite there, is it?
Bit weird. So, you know, who knows, if McLaren had put been a proper orange on its F1 car, maybe we'd have had 2 million people turning up to the Circuit de Catalunya for pre-season F1 testing.
I think that one's a little bit optimistic. It does show that this is a once-in-a-lifetime event in a way. It's so rare that this sort of thing happens. That's perhaps a little bit grandiose. But missing a Grand Prix, driving for what should be a top team but very much isn't a top team, going off to do Indy is just this incredible story. Nothing compares to it since Mansell. So it's no great surprise that this has caught people's imagination. It's great that Indy and McLaren have actually realised what the potential of this is. Because normally a test is you just turn up behind closed doors. But they made this a media event.
Well, it's so unusual as well, isn't it? As you say, if you go back, you know, 30, 40 years, a lot of the top drives of any given category would have done lots of other things. There actually is still, there's more of it than you think, but in terms of the front guys, your absolute top guys, they tend to, by necessity, have to focus and specialise on a particular category, F1 being the obvious one. This is a great example of that not happening. It counters that, and I think that's captured a lot of people's imaginations.
I love the fact that they put so much effort into it. When are you ever really going to properly pay attention to the build-up to the Indy 500 or a guy who's, you know, tugging around at the back of the Formula One grid? This is a double world champion. He's going off to do what it doesn't get done. You don't skip the showpiece event of a Formula One season to go and do Indy 500. So the fact that they went, you know, above and beyond to put the people who care about this story and make them feel part of it, that's the big thing for me. You know, we live in what is the most sort of connected age of our, you know, human history. In motorsport terms, the way we use that extra connectivity these days through the internet and stuff is to go on forums and bash each other's series and say, oh, my series is, you know, better than yours. F1 is this, WEC is that, Formula E is this, that and the other. And actually, you've got these tools at your disposal to just become more and more ingrained, right down to the details of hearing Alonso give his first bits of feedback to the Andretti team on the pit wall. That you can't get that. I mean, how much would people have killed 20, 30 years ago when, you know, Senna rocked up and did a test somewhere or someone
they
went
tested a Firebird in the Penske.
Yeah, exactly. So just imagine having that insight. You know, that is, you know, unrivaled access. You know, no, motorsport fans throughout history have never had this before. So absolutely fair play to everyone involved for giving them that platform.
I would agree with that, but I would also say that, of course, the American racing culture is much better at that anyway. So it's good that McLaren and Alonso, that they've picked up on the American side rather than bringing a sort of slightly closed door F1 approach within IndyCar. So they're actually maximising the opportunity for people to get excited about it and, as you say, really see what's going on. Because also this will probably be, for some people, a bit of an introduction or a reintroduction to IndyCar. So they'll almost be learning as Alonso goes along, as they'll be paying more interest now than they would ever have done before.
We've got to be careful, obviously, because you don't want to turn around and say, well, this is the reason why we should, you know, broadcast all F1 tests and stuff like that, because it's very, very rare that you're going to have this kind of story to talk about.
I think the lesson of this is that if there's something really interesting happening, make sure people can see it, can consume it, can watch it, can be a part of it. That's the key. Like you say, you can't make everything an event. Indianapolis broadcast all of practice live last year over the internet, but was getting a few tens of thousands watching because fundamentally practice is fairly dull. But it was a great opportunity to get people looking at Indy. It would be fascinating to know how many people who watched that had never watched a car go around an oval before. Alonso did a decent job as well. It wasn't the most trying thing he'll have ever done. Yes, it was a completely alien world. The rookie orientation test is a fairly procedural, straightforward thing. He has to do 10 laps at 205 to 210 miles an hour, 15 laps at 210 to 215 miles an hour, and then 15 laps at above 215 miles an hour, which is fairly straightforward. The pole time last year was 230.946 mile an hour, should I say, the pole speed. Obviously, that's how they do it on the ovals. His fastest of the day over the 110 laps was 222.548. He was about familiarising himself with it. He was doing bits and pieces like using the race day pit lane, because you have to use the practice pit entry through most of that. So he's familiarising himself with that, the communications, getting to know the car, the team. So that will really help him in terms of when practice starts on the Monday after the Spanish Grand Prix for the 2 weeks that now is the month of May for the Indy 500.
Well, I think we'd all be very surprised if Fernando didn't get into the ballpark of being competitive pretty quickly. Obviously, the two big challenges he's going to have is to go really quick on an oval. We need to trim out the wing. So to start with, they'll give him quite a lot of downforce and the car will seem really stable and great, but it won't be very fast. And obviously, as he gets more confident, they'll start taking the downforce off and it will start getting more and more nervous. And that's, of course, when he's going to have to be really careful, because obviously, if you're in the wall and you either injure yourself or you damage the car, then that's the end of your running. And of course, the other thing, which a lot of sort of oval experts have been talking about, is running in traffic. You can get the car to run perfectly well on its own, but as soon as you're running side by side or immediately behind another car, that really does affect the way that the car responds, and that's actually what you've got to set the car up for.
He's already showing signs that he quote gets oval racing. And I remember when I spoke to Dario Franchitti last year when Max Chilton was going over to IndyCar racing for the first time. Dario, in his first season, he said he was very hit and miss. Sometimes he would be really quick on ovals, but he wouldn't know why. He didn't really know sort of what he needed to get out of the car to go quickly. And that's going to be one of the big challenges for Alonso, is obviously trying to get his car into a window where he knows what's working, why it's working, and that he can push as close to 100% as possible without having to worry about ever overstepping the mark. So ticking those boxes early on in that test and then starting to, as you say, trim out the rear wing and that sort of thing, and just get it all a bit more lively is really important.
He's watched a huge amount of material from the Indy 500 as well already. He's been watching races. He's watched at least one full race from an onboard feed to get a feel for it. Apparently he's done some work in the Dallara simulator, simulating wind conditions and that kind of thing. Fernando Alonso is a really sharp guy. He approaches everything in a very professional kind of way. It's a bit reminiscent, actually, of when Mansell went to IndyCar in 1993, over the winter. He did a huge amount of preparation involving watching videos, getting to understand his rivals and his competitors. And the fascinating thing will be, I think we can assume Alonso will be pretty competitive. I think his pace will be decent. He'll be in the mix in the race, certainly, as you'd say. Dario Franchitti last Friday in an event at McLaren, which was part of IndyCar's kind of European tour, as they tried to talk up IndyCar and build on the interest generated by Alonso, he said that Alonso probably will be shocked at how frenetic it gets in the closing stages, the cut and thrust. If you have everyone out, relatively late caution, everyone on fresh rubber, really going for it to win the Indy 500. You can be quite polite earlier in the race, but that's when the experience really counts, knowing who you can take risks with, who you can trust, who's a little bit leery. That's going to be the big unknown for Alonso. Well, let's head down the more demotivating line for Fernando Alonso. Obviously, before Indy, he's got the Spanish Grand Prix this weekend. We'll be looking forward to that. Fernando Alonso's 1,500-1 to win the race, 2,000-1 to be on pole. I'd say those are pretty poor odds, considering how hard he has to happen. And he's 500-1 even to be on the podium.
I'm amazed there are any odds at all, really. I suppose it could rain.
Well, I think even if it rains, I think it's one of those ones. I did see an F3 race years ago at the Circuit de Catalunya, where basically every single car crashed at the first corner. It was the weekend and Andy Suchek won the championship. It was the most amazing thing, and the race wasn't red flagged. There were cars all over the gravel.
It's comfortably my favourite thing to share on YouTube.
Let's look up at the front. We've had this great fight between Mercedes and Ferrari so far this year. It's two wins apiece for Ferrari and Mercedes. Sebastian Vettel leads the world championship. Now, going into Spain, again looking at the odds, Lewis Hamilton is still the slight favourite, 6-4 to win the race, with Sebastian Vettel at 13-8. And then you've got Russian Grand Prix winner Valtteri Bottas at 4-1, Kimi Raikkonen at 11-1. So the bookies are still leaning with Mercedes. Now, I should add that this is a British bookie site I'm looking at, there will be a little bit of a bias towards Lewis Hamilton because there'll be a lot of home money, shall we say, on that. But it's very close. And I think the fact that we're going there and we still couldn't say which one's definitely going to win is really positive for the season.
Yeah, I think they probably got those odds about right, really. You still kind of think that if Mercedes can get it together, they've had a couple of tactical errors, they're not quite working the tyres properly, but they do have fundamentally a good car. You know, they've only had three of the first four poles. You've got to think that Lewis Hamilton is very unlikely to have a weekend as poor as he had in Russia.
Oh, that will be as bad as it gets for Hamilton, no question.
So he'll be back there. Bottas has obviously cracked it, even though Sochi has always been a good track for him. I think those three are likely to be in the mix, because Ferrari, we know, can get out qualified at this season and still be in the hunt for victory. What we really want to see is Hamilton and Vettel not getting delayed, not making bad starts, and actually having a proper fight for it at the front, because we kind of keep missing it this year one way or another.
It's going to be difficult, because Spain again will be a tricky circuit for that, because overtaking there is really, really difficult. The main overtaking spot tends to be into turn one, and because it's not a slow corner as such, it's quite difficult to launch an attack there, even with DRS assistance. So I think we could see another Spanish Grand Prix that's all about track position.
Probably be the biggest test so far of the new cars, won't it? Because I think we were all braced at the start of the season for an opening set of races that were quite underwhelming. Generally speaking, if you were sensible about it and you say, okay, we're switching to a formula that's more aerodynamically powerful than ever and more aerodynamically dependent, then it doesn't really bode well for following closely and close racing. I've personally found the first three races to be extremely entertaining, and even in the Russian Grand Prix, which was boring for the majority, it had a very good opening 30 seconds in the run down to turn two, and then obviously it came good at the end.
I think that's key, isn't it? You can have two ways of an interesting race. One is the obvious wheel-to-wheel battle, cars overtaking each other and all the rest of it, but actually, as you say, Russia wasn't like that at all. But you did have that thing right to the very end. You weren't quite sure who's going to win between two different teams. So I don't think every race has to be an overtaking fest to be interesting. And that's why it's so great that Ferrari seem to have got their act together this year. And we genuinely don't know going into this weekend which car will be fastest, never mind which driver's going
to
win.
Ultimately, it's about the storylines, isn't it? Is there a storyline in the race? That's what people want to see. And I think there should be this weekend. Obviously, the new factor, shall we say, is Spain is always a race where we see a quite big package of upgrades. Obviously, teams have bought bits and pieces to the early races, but this is big packages. Red Bull have talked up their package. A lot of new parts coming on it. Some people have characterised it as a new car. That's going a little bit far, but it's going to be a big step for Red Bull, and it needs to be. They're about 1.7 seconds off in qualifying in Sochi.
It's been
a terrible start to the season for them, but Ferrari will have new parts. Mercedes will have new parts. Niki Lauda, non-executive chairman, I think is his title, of Mercedes, has said the season will start new. So there is kind of a reset point here and a chance for people to throw a lot of parts at the car. So are we expecting to see much of a reset in terms of the competitive balance between, firstly, the top two and then Red Bull's position relative to them?
Well, this will be the test for Ferrari, won't it? Because last year they got overtaken by Red Bull during the course of the season. Now, you could say, well, Red Bull started further back than they probably should have done, and maybe have done again this year. But now Ferrari have shown that they can produce a car that's up there with Mercedes at the start of the year. Can they throw enough bits at it, and bits that work, more importantly, to maintain that fight? That will be really key now. And Spain will be our first real look at how the teams are doing on the upgrade front.
Yeah, there are two things that I'm sort of particularly interested in. First is, again, building on what Kevin just said about it being the first test for Ferrari. You know, I couldn't really shake the feeling at the start of this year that the quality of this year's car was a bit of a hangover from before James Allison left. My gut feeling would be that, you know, Allison would have been heavily involved up to before the point of his departure, so there would have been quite a lot of work done there. And now the big test is for the team that has replaced him, you know, this so-called horizontal structure. Is it Matteo Binotto is in charge of?
Yeah, Matteo Binotto, yeah. Who was from the engine side, who's now technical director at Ferrari, with a little bit of assistance from Rory Byrne in a consultancy basis, but Byrne is not full-time, so that this is Binotto's technical team.
Exactly. So this technical team now has the... let's say, for example, it was an Allison car to whatever degree, this is now Binotto and his team's opportunity to show that actually, you know, they're the guys that are going to take this car, which was, you know, had a very good base, to a title this year, because obviously they're going to be the guys that are central to Ferrari keeping pace in the development race. I would say the second thing that I'm looking forward to seeing this weekend is what Red Bull can bring to the table on in terms of, you know, aerodynamic upgrades, what they can physically do to the chassis to halve the deficit. Because I'm presuming they can only halve the deficit, because Daniel Ricciardo, Christian Horner, Max Verstappen, they've all said that the problem at the moment is as much to do with the car as it is the engine. They didn't have really an official deadline for the engine upgrade, but it looks like that's not going to be Montreal as originally targeted by the likes of the customer team Red Bull. So if that Renault engine is the same as what we've seen in the first four races, then how I can't see Red Bull making a big step this weekend, which is a shame, because obviously you would say Red Bull, you know, Barcelona being a circuit that rewards high downforce cars, and obviously we saw Verstappen win on his debut there last year, can't for the life of me seeing that get repeated this weekend.
Well, they could make a big step in terms of performance, couldn't they, and still you wouldn't tell, because they're ahead of the midfield pack and they're quite a way off the front two, so they might have a really significant upgrade and still be fifth and sixth.
We're not going to see a dramatic change in terms of the wider pattern. I think we'll still see the two top teams up at the front. It'll be interesting to see how things shift between them. But it's rare now that we see these dramatic, massive swings in performance with upgrades. All the teams are too good now. Because obviously, let's say you've got a second to make up. You don't only have to find a second. You have to find what everyone else ahead of you has found, plus a second.
It will be interesting to see how Force India get on, though, because they've had some correlation issues, haven't they?
They're hoping will solve that.
So they might, in a way, they should be the ones that make the most ground, partly because they've got a flaw that they've been fighting.
Solving a flaw with a flaw.
Yeah, and but also because it's so tight in that midfield group. You know, they've done a fantastic job to get the points that they have.
100% points finishing record. There are two cars in the points in all four races.
And, yeah, we'll get into this another time perhaps, but they've got two strong drivers at midfield pack, which quite a few of the other teams that they're fighting against do not have. So if they then bring an upgrade to the car, suddenly you could see them going, well, actually, they're going to be, you know, seventh and eighth.
They do genuinely deserve massive credit, because, okay, in a way, they've done a bad job because they've not built a very good car out of the blocks. But what they've done, actually, in terms of executing the race operations, has been superb. So you would hope that that's going to be rewarded by them going, we've recognised what was wrong, now we're going to fix that. And then maybe they can target Red Bull. If Red Bull don't make that step this weekend, the Mercedes engine is good, maybe we'll see Force India make a massive step forward. Who knows?
You used an interesting word there, which is the word credit, which is going to bring us on to our next point, the financial payments to teams. Now, Dieter Rankin, a regular long-time contributor to Autosport, a columnist, always very much into the business and commercial side. He unearths things that others rarely do. And each year he has a good record of releasing the Formula One payments to teams based on the projections of their shares of revenue, etc. Now, to bear with me a little bit as I explain this, the revenues are paid on several things. Column one, which is so-called historic payments. If you're in the top 10, 2 out of 3 years in the Constructors' Championship, you get the column one payment. That's an equal $36 million share each. So all of the teams apart from Haas are getting that. Column two is based upon the Constructors' Championship position of the previous year. So Mercedes gets $61 million US dollars for that. Ferrari was third, gets 41, down to 13 for Sauber in 10th place, having pit manner. And there's also a few other payments. Ferrari gets $68 million for being a long-standing team, plus $35 million for being a former Constructors' Championship-winning team. The upshot of all of this is that if you look at the share of what is $940 million, everyone's sharing, Ferrari is the biggest earner, having finished only third last year, $180 million US dollars. Mercedes gets $171 million. Red Bull, $161 million. McLaren, $97 million, and Williams, $79 million. Now, those are all the teams that are getting the extra bonuses. The remaining teams are all getting it based purely upon the historic payment and the previous year's constructors. So you've got Force India, $72 million, Toro Rosso, $59 million, Renault, $52 million, Sauber, $49 million, and then Haas gets $19 million for its position in last year's constructors. Now, that really does illustrate how uneven the revenue is. That is a classic case of the rich getting richer, isn't it?
This is clearly weighted in favour of people who have been around the longest and have the biggest voice. You know, shout the loudest, you get the biggest slice of the pie. And you know, maybe sport's supposed to be cutthroat. Maybe this is supposed to be a dog-eat-dog world. But this is equal parts sport and entertainment, Formula One. And I cannot understand how this sort of financial structure sort of promotes that.
Well, I mean, you could have a debate about whether, you know, the teams that are winning should get more for the following year, because you do end up with a situation where the rich get richer, but you also want a meritocracy where you do get reward for being the best. But this goes even beyond that, because, like Ed was saying, you know, Ferrari, third in the Constructors' Championship last year, gets the biggest payout because of this historical thing. So when you're up against that, you know, the harshest comparison for me is Force India. In fourth in the Constructors' Championship on 72, one place behind Ferrari on 180. So how are they ever going to make the jump to the top three if they're that far down? You know, spending does equal lap time to a degree. You know, if we're all saying we want a sporting contest between as many teams as possible, this is a structure which basically mitigates against that.
I don't really understand sort of what Formula One's owners, what Liberty can sort of expect to achieve long term. There's a lot of talk at the moment about what Liberty wants to do with Formula One, and a lot of it's talked, you know, in the context of what they can do for fans and stuff like this. The best thing they can do for fans is sort this mess out, because if they sort this mess out, we actually might have a formula of Grand Prix racing that's actually sort of regularly entertaining, fairer and better across the board.
Well, the window of opportunity for that will be after 2020. The current bilateral agreements that dictate these payments is basically signed, sealed, delivered to the end of 2020. So we'll have to see what happens in 2021 and beyond. But there's a lot of talk about Formula One Group spending more money on promotion and marketing. Well, okay, that's going to come out of the money that's being shared. And obviously they're going to have their own stakeholders they want to give money to. So I think it would be a mistake just to automatically assume that Formula One Group, as we should now call it, is going to be taking this really altruistic, sensible view to it. I think they'll take a more constructive view towards it, but the pressure cannot let up on them to create something that is a proper, sustainable, collective Formula One, shall we say. Because these things tend to go a little bit out the window when Ferrari sits down around the table and says, well, we think you need us more than we need you, so this is what we want. And McLaren does that, and Mercedes and Red Bull, and people start threatening to take their money away and their toys away and go elsewhere. So that's going to be a real test of their negotiating prowess. Well, let's move on to the listener questions now. We've had various questions come in via social media. If you'd like to ask a question of the Autosport podcast, just tweet us on @Autosport or use the hashtag AskAutosport. You can direct some questions at us. Every now and again, we'll ask the question on Facebook as well. We reserve the right not to answer your questions, depending on how much there is to talk about. But it's always nice to have a little bit of listener interaction. So the first question is, do you think Valtteri Bottas will be a title contender? Or will this win be a flash in the pan like Heikki Kovalainen's? That's come from Dennis Knight.
Yes, I think he will be a title contender. Whether he will be this year is another matter, but I think I just certainly wouldn't say it was a flash in the pan that we saw in Russia. I'd like to say I don't remember Kovalainen having a flash in the pan either at all at any point. He won one Grand Prix when Felipe Massa blew up towards the end of the race, but he was
a race in which Lewis Hamilton had a puncture as well.
Yeah.
So it's a shame because Kovalainen was a driver, well, it still is a driver with a wonderful level of ability, but perhaps not the mental robustness, shall we say, to thrive in that environment. Heikki's a very, very good driver, but he just couldn't quite make it work. I think Valtteri has got a bit more to him in terms of the ability to withstand that. He's already passed his first test by getting a win. He's already out-qualified Hamilton a couple of times. He's won a Grand Prix. So in the first four races, he's done a pretty good job.
He's also four races in. He's done something that we didn't really see from Rosberg very much, which is absolutely destroy Hamilton over a Grand Prix weekend. I mean, we saw maybe two times during Rosberg's title winning season last year, Baku in Singapore. The only, from memory, they're the only two times I saw, especially last season, Rosberg properly have the edge over Hamilton from start to finish. And at Sochi, four races in, after getting his first pole last time out, Bottas has already, you know, it's a big tick for Bottas in terms of what he would have wanted to achieve early on.
Well, also, I mean, there's not really a better way to win a Grand Prix, is there? Not only has he completely thumped his triple world champion teammate, but he's then proved that he can cope with the pressure with, you know, a four-time world champion bearing down. Now, of course, he did make that mistake and lock up, and actually wasn't a million miles away from putting it in the wall, but he did recover, and when Vettel actually did arrive, he didn't do that. He did what he needed to do. And I would expect him, I think the race before in Bahrain, where he was on pole but then had a pretty appalling race, to be honest, That was the other end of the spectrum for Bottas. I'm much more expecting that the races during this year will tend more towards Russia. I don't think Lewis will be that weak again, frankly.
That's the question, isn't it? At what point is he going to be able to beat Hamilton, who's having close to a very strong weekend, should we say, rather than being half a second off? Because Lewis Hamilton is one of the all-time greats. He's rarely going to struggle to that extent.
Yeah, well, Rosberg couldn't really beat Hamilton when Hamilton was absolutely on it. But last year, combination of factors, we've discussed before, unreliability, Lewis not getting off the line, there were enough chinks in the armour and Rosberg was close enough, fair play to him, to take advantage. And sort of Bottas has got to get himself into that position. And certainly Russia was perhaps the first sign that is a genuine possibility.
So fairly simple answer to that question. He will be a title contender at some stage, Dennis. He's certainly not going to be a one-hit wonder. I'd be pretty sure Valtteri Bottas will win more Grand Prix in his career. Our next question comes from Chris Adams, who says, I'm intrigued by the fascination of the triple crown possibility of Fernando Alonso. No one is mentioning Juan Pablo Montoya being two-thirds of the way. There's a fairly simple answer to that in that he isn't doing Le Mans, which is the one he's missing, so he's not really relevant to this debate. But wouldn't that be great to see Montoya getting a Le Mans drive with a shot of adding to his Indy and Monaco wins?
Yeah, he's one of the great modern versatile drivers, isn't he? Because remember, he managed to win in NASCAR as well. So as well as F1 and Indy, he's done a bit of NASCAR. And yeah, he's a sort of great character to have around. You've got to think he's probably past his best now. So to go and win Le Mans would require, well, you always need luck to win Le Mans, of course. But
nobody past their best has ever won Le Mans.
Well, now that's a whole podcast in itself, I think. So yeah, it'd be great to see him there. And frankly, I'd like to see Alonso there after he's won the Indy 500.
That's the one thing that's a bit of a shame, that both Toyota and Porsche have said there's no space for Alonso in the foreseeable future in their team. There's only five cars, basically, that can win Le Mans, three Toyotas and two Porsches at the moment. So that's unfortunate.
Don't forget, with Montoya, we were teased by the fact that he took part in that Bahrain test, didn't he?
But, yeah, in 2015.
But the problem with that was obviously the shelving of the third car. Just if there was ever anything on the cards, that was immediately lost by the fact that, well, unfortunately, that's not going to be sort of on the radar. I know Toyota have done it for this season with the third car, but until someone takes a punt, and the thing is, someone like Toyota, they're adding that third car to try and sort of boost their chances, and you're not going to just sort of chuck in a driver on a sort of sentimentality, are you? You're going to go to win.
Absolutely. Well, I think Alonso's got more of a chance because he's obviously got so much clout at McLaren. He might say to them, right, okay, chaps, right, let's go and make an LMP1 car now.
Get Gordon Murray on the phone.
Yes.
Realistically, it's not impossible Montoya could do it. Alonso is probably a more likely shot to get the Triple Crown, which is a strange thing to say given he's only won one of the races. But Montoya would need to get into a top car at Le Mans and actually be able to win the race. He has won the Daytona 24 Hours, so he's getting there. But
could we put Montoya into a Clearwater Ferrari or something and get him to win GTE AM?
Well, talking of the Triple Crown, there is some debate, isn't there? Because we've had some correspondents eloquently arguing that the Triple Crown should not contain the Monaco Grand Prix, but the Formula One World Championship, which would bring others into it. Jacques Villeneuve, for example, who's won the Indy 500, won the World Championship, not the Monaco Grand Prix, finished second at Le Mans, so he's almost there. But my personal view of that is it's a triple crown of race wins, so it's coherent for it to be three individual races, yeah, sure.
To me, that's nonsense. Though, if you're going to do that, then it has to be the Formula One World Championship, the IndyCar Series, and the World Endurance Championship, or whatever version of the World Endurance Championship exists.
I mean, I do agree with that, but I think it kind of partly comes from this, from the Graham Hill, because I think he's actually quoted as talking about the Triple Crown
Well, he made it up, basically.
Exactly. But this is your point about it being a nebulous concept, isn't it, really? It's not really anything. We like talking about it because you pick out the big races, and it makes much more sense that it's a single race from each thing.
Well, it's the showpiece events, isn't it? That's the point.
Yeah.
So if I like it. We have this idea that these are the races that respectively they're the jewels in their respective crowns. And so I presume that this glorious triple crown of which we speak has sort of three rubies at the front, and it's Indy 500, Le Mans, and the Monaco Grand Prix.
Well, in fairness, the one thing you could say about, and by the way, of course, with Alonso, it doesn't actually make any difference anyway, because he's got both Monaco Grand Prix wins and World Championship to his name, so it doesn't really matter from Alonso's point of view. But I think you could make an argument for Indy 500 is so obviously the biggest IndyCar race by a mile. Le Mans is the sports car race, you know. It basically maintains sports car racing even when the World Championship died. It's that big. Is Monaco Grand Prix quite that big in the F1 calendar? I don't think it is, but it's probably the closest thing that we've got to it in the sort of wider world.
I think it is in terms of the perception on the outside.
Yep.
If you speak to the proverbial man on the street that's always being cited. Yeah, the Monaco Grand Prix is the one.
Images
that is
of the harbour and stuff like that, plus the fact that it still maintains that sort of spike in popularity, even though nowadays it goes up on the same weekend against massive events like the Indianapolis 500 and the World Rallycross Championship round at Linden Hill.
Oh, nice!
Rallycross has been mentioned by Scott Mitchell.
That was seamless.
This was inevitable. This was inevitable. But it would be great to see Montoya having a crack at it. He'd have a shot. He's one of, I think, six drivers who've won two of the Triple Crown events. The others are Tazio Nuvolari, Maurice Trintignant, AJ Foyt, Bruce McLaren and Jochen Rindt. I can't see any of those five adding to it, although I wouldn't put it past AJ Foyt, even at his age. He's a pretty remarkable one. You could see him turning up at the Monaco Grand Prix and showing everyone the way. But, yeah.
I'm struggling a little bit with that, but absolutely.
Don't rule anything out where AJ's
a total legend, yeah. Yeah, no, that's fair enough. Well, how about why don't we put Montoya, Alonso and Jenson Button in an LMP1 car? Come on, Ed, you can arrange this. You're important and all that.
You raise the budget, I'll put it together.
I'll leave the budget to Scott.
So, next question from Geordie Pugh. Should tyre warmers be banned across all of motorsport?
Yes. Brilliant idea.
Yeah, I agree. One of the things I like in Formula E, going back to my little world of electric racing, I like the fact that these cars aren't particularly quick, but they're really, really difficult to drive. And part of that is obviously they've got all-weather tyres. So I don't think the tyres offer sort of like a particular, you know, particularly high peak of grip. But also the fact that they don't have tyre warmers means that the guys are going out there on cold tyres and cold brakes, and it's hard to get the temperature into them. It's one of the nuances of driving a Formula E car. Obviously, in Formula E, it's particularly special because you're adding that to the fact that they're on bumpy, dusty street circuits that, you know, with the exception of one or two places, never get used. So it's not like there's banks of data to go off of. So it is difficult on its own, but it's just that extra little bit that just makes it a bit trickier. And you've got to know how to sort of react to that. And it tests drivers to get things right in practice, nail it over one lap in qualifying, be quick on the first couple of laps of the race and the first couple of laps of a stint. I think it's just a good extra challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. It provides another opportunity for a driver to make a difference, doesn't it? Because some people can just nail it straight away. Actually, I think that'd be the sort of thing that Alonso would be very good at on the first lap. You can imagine getting stuck in there. I imagine Lewis would be pretty good at it as well. And other drivers being a bit more attentive, you see a bit more overtaking perhaps. You might see a few more incidents of people making mistakes, but you know, it's also, of course, it would save a bit of money not having tyre warmers as well.
Let's just use something from this year as an example. Go back to the Bahrain Grand Prix and the restart when Ricciardo was on soft tyres and he couldn't get them up to temperature. And he went from sort of being in the position, what's he going to do? Is he going to get it into you know, the mix with the lead battle here? Where can he put his car? And then all of a sudden he's swallowed up by, you know, a Ferrari, a Mercedes and a Williams. And it's just like, oh, he just couldn't do it. And that's not necessarily, that's down to perhaps a quirk of the tyre and the way his car works. But ultimately, you've got to deal with it. And you imagine if you had that story multiplied by 20 across the entire grid.
Well, if you look at it, the drivers and the engineers, in fact, this is something Nico Rosberg was very good at, I think, is why he could sometimes get on top of Lewis Hamilton in qualifying, is that when everything's optimised, they know where the limits of the car are. And it's when you have to improvise, whether it's wet, something's changed, wheel to wheel. And this would just be another example of, oh, not quite sure where the car's at. And you've got to sort of make it up, improvise a bit as you go along.
I think the interesting thing is that this has been discussed in Formula One a few times. I can think of at least three separate occasions when a tyre warmer ban has been discussed or even tentatively agreed over the past 7 or 8 years in Formula One. And the problem always is that it's done on a bit of an ad hoc basis because the tyres are designed to work with tyre blankets. So what they actually need to do is say, right, 4 years down the line, we're going to get rid of the tyre blankets. And then the tyre manufacturer has the time to work towards them rather than kind of coming up with this quite a good idea and then implementing it badly because you've got tyres that you wouldn't have a chance of getting up to temperature. But it would also eliminate some of the black art of the way you cook the tyres, etc., as it were, and cure them. There's a lot of science in that. It's really, really difficult to know how to get the tyres prepped correctly, and it's an area the top teams work on, so it'd eliminate that as well, and it would create a distinct driver influenced variable in deciding the outcome of races. So I think it's a good idea. It just has to be implemented properly rather than at random. Our next question is from Dennis Keskin, who hopefully I've got his name right, who asks, have Romain Grosjean and Nico Hülkenberg, who he calls two of the best talents of their generation, missed their chance ever to fight for a title. Grosjean looks vulnerable at Haas, and the Hulk faces a long walk back to the top with Renault. Will they ever reach the summit?
I'd say Hülkenberg's actually facing his best chance, isn't he? He's not really had the break he's needed, but he's finally aligned himself to a factory team. And okay, Renault's not there at the moment, but outside of the big three, you've got to say Renault is probably better placed at the moment to put together a title challenging car and engine combination than say McLaren Honda. On the other side, Romain Grosjean. I was a big fan of Grosjean up against Raikkonen at Lotus, and I felt that he was maturing into this guy who was capable of big things if he got the right opportunity. But to be honest, since he's been at Haas, I know he delivered big at the start of last year, but I didn't really feel like he completely hammered Gutierrez over the remainder of the season. And my main thing about him this year is, you know, Magnussen's looked quite good. Grosjean was nowhere at Sochi, and has since admitted that as much of that was down to him as it was him not being able to find the right balance in his car. And just from sort of anecdotal evidence I've heard from people that have gone trackside, he constantly moans about the brakes, but I've heard that, you know, someone should tell him that he's braking later than anyone else is at certain parts of the track. I think that was a phrase that Gary Anderson quite liked to use in pre-season testing. I don't quite see in Grosjean now what I saw sort of 2 or 3 years ago, whereas Hülkenberg I kind of only see an upward trajectory.
I pretty much agree with that. I mean, I think I felt very sorry for him. I'm a bit of a fan of Hülkenberg, and I felt sorry for him when he went for Renault and then almost instantly Nico Rosberg retired, and you thought, oh, he probably would have been on, he'd have been on the shortlist for that drive, surely.
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt, they did make an inquiry.
And that, I think, would have been, and that's nothing against Bottas, who I think also deserved a chance in the midfield. You probably picked those two as the guys that did. But the Renaults made such a big progress this year, because let's face it, they were right at the back last year at times. And he's clearly, he seems to be thriving in the environment. He's not got to worry about, you know, his teammate so much. He can focus on driving that. He's the obvious number one. The team, it's not that long ago, from a team perspective, it's a long time ago for Fernando Alonso. From a team perspective, it's not that long ago that they won or were fighting for championships. So, yeah, my hope would be that they can get there. We need more teams at the front. And Grosjean, yeah, he's too inconsistent, isn't he? He'll be absolutely sublime. He's sort of a bit Carlos Reutemann-y. He can sublime one weekend and be absolutely amazing and then just completely anonymous the next.
I think Grosjean, he's a difficult one. Obviously, Haas have had a few problems with getting the most out of the car. That's maybe accentuated a bit. I think the way he communicates over the radio maybe exaggerates it a little bit. But he does have this problem with having a very clear idea of how he wants the brakes to behave. The old ART school of brake hard, turn in aggressively, which you can't always do. So he needs to understand and adapt to that in order to get the best out of himself. When he can, he drove extraordinarily well in the second half of 2013. Some of the best drives we've seen in Formula One in the past decade during that period. So I suspect probably the ship has sailed for Grosjean in terms of he's missed a shot at Ferrari. You never say never, but 31, perhaps he's going to have to rely on circumstances helping him to the front. But Hülkenberg, yeah, with Renault, he has actually got a trajectory that could get him to the front. He's still only 29, so he's got a sort of a couple of years on Grosjean, which is helpful in terms of the time he's got to go. So maybe we see Hülkenberg competing for the Triple Crown. He's already done Le Mans.
Of course he has. And one very, very quick point on Grosjean, which is obviously sort of moving away a little bit from this, but we've obviously talked about Alonso and sort of what's going on with him at the moment. And I know one of the big talking points is obviously if he left McLaren, what would McLaren do? Because the top line drivers, who's going to want to go there? Well, Boullier is a bit of a fan of Grosjean, isn't he? Obviously worked very closely with him before and was constantly challenging Grosjean, you know, sort your head out and you're going to be mega. And I think he backed him. It would be worse bets, wouldn't there, you know, for Grosjean and McLaren if that was a union that would work.
You'd always go for the driver who's got the pace and the potential to deliver something extraordinary over the one who you know is a good, solid, reliable performer. Boullier was able to get the best out of him. He really helped him revive his career, Grosjean, after his initial foray into Formula One in 2009 when he did a part season with the Renault team. Yeah, Boullier knows what he can do and knows how to get the best out of him. So that's an option, because if you're a team that's not performing at the highest level, you do sometimes have to cut your cloth accordingly and end up signing a driver maybe who is either unfulfilled for a reason or could do better or needs the right environment in order to deliver. So that's not impossible.
Can we move on to emissions and fuel consumption now?
Always, always. Johnny Punder has asked, do you think the next F1 engine should have set emissions and fuel consumption regulations rather than capacity, etc. Now, obviously, a few years down the line, we've got the new engine regulations, which have to be low cost, road relevant, sensible, so that they can be a level playing field. Kev, you can have this one.
I think it's a very interesting question. I think people that just want big, loud V12s, it's all very good, but that is not where technology and road cars are going.
Bring back Super League Formula.
Well, if you want to see that, go and watch the historic race meeting.
That's your answer to everything.
To many. But no, I mean, I think I was talking to an engineer on this, and his suggestion was quite interesting. That the fuel consumption, you say that where F1 went with the fuel consumption formula was right, but they shouldn't have limited the flow. So he said that would then give you all sorts of different options during the course of the race. So somebody might be quick at the beginning, quick at the end, in the middle, whatever. It would give you more variables, which means that you'd have cars that were quicker at different points of the race, which is effectively what we introduced with Pirellis that degrade. And he thought that would be good for the racing while also encouraging the technology. And then as the teams get better and better at that, then you give them a bit less fuel for the following season. So, yeah, I think that fuel consumption emissions, good for driving the technology, less of an issue in terms of F1 itself because the emissions it puts out are minuscule. And the engines are actually incredibly efficient. The same guy was telling me they are, even the internal combustion engine of an F1 car now, without all the bits on, is more efficient than the Toyota Prius engine. That gives you an idea of how far they've got. But yeah, absolutely, I think that should definitely be part of new rules.
Just as a note on the fuel flow, the FIA's argument on the fuel flow and the reason that regulation was introduced was to avoid ridiculous discrepancies in power, because you could have an engine configuration that just puts out ridiculous power and end up with very big end of straight speed differentials. That's their argument. I'm not endorsing it. I'm just saying that's the reason.
I think engineers would very quickly work out that wasn't the optimum way of doing it. I think that there would be a bit of... Eventually, of course, all variation disappears because evolution tells you that there is the best way of doing it. But I suspect you wouldn't have one car with 1,600 brake horsepower and another one with 300. I just don't think that the disparity would be that great. But then I'm not an engineer, so,
I agree on the points about fuel consumption. I think that's the most sort of interesting bit in Johnny's question. The problem for me with Formula One, maybe motorsport in general, is we're incredibly lucky to work in this environment, but it is a bubble and does it often try and sort of exist in isolation to the rest of the world. But you've got to reflect what's going on in the wider world, but also it does still have a responsibility to the wider world as well. And Formula One can be a showcase for manufacturers to nail really complex technology that will actually make a difference. And I think if you can have a situation where you build an electric powertrain in Formula E, or this incredible hybrid system, power regeneration system in WEC, or a turbo hybrid in Formula One, whatever, if you can do something where and you can physically provide a tangible sort of way of showing to the public, you can do this on such little fuel. Before we were using this much, now we're using 10% less, 15% less, whatever. That's totally relevant.
You certainly want to have emissions regulations. There's no question about that. You don't want to be putting who knows what out there. Ideally, you want to be developing some relevant technology, and fuel consumption has to be part of that. But I think what you need to do, you have to have your key elements in mind when you spec it. Cost needs to be part of that. If you want it to be road relevant, which they say they do, well, what do the manufacturers want to work on? You could say, as one proposal, have a spec internal combustion engine produced by, for want of argument, Cosworth, and then you build the energy recovery system ancillaries onto it, however you want to do it. There's all sorts of ways you can set that up, but I think it's important to actually understand what it should be first. But I certainly agree, you don't want to be using ridiculous amounts of fuel, because that's just out of step with what the world is doing. And actually, it's nice to have the noise, but I think over time that's going to be less of a thing for people. Yeah, you lose that initial smash you in the face wow factor with it when you first see the cars, but there's also more texture to the sound. And in general, talking about motorsport as a whole, noise is a big problem. Now, how many circuits have difficulties with running because of the noise, etc., from the engines? I don't know whether we've really answered that, but I think, yes, emissions and consumption needs to be part of it. I think just setting a capacity and off you go is a very old school way of doing it. I think we need to be more elaborate than that. But that's a big question for Osborne and his team to solve. Hopefully, fairly quickly. We need to have a reasonably clear direction on this in the next year or so. The next question is from Jim Rogers. If Alonso were to somehow win the championship in 2018, it would be a new record for gap between titles. Would a third title after 12 years be as glorious as he hopes, or would it always be qualified as a sad anomaly in the history of the sport?
That'd be glorious, wouldn't it? It would be like the perfect, because you've got to think that by that point, 2018, you're looking at the conclusion of his Formula One career, and what a way for that story to end. It's been adversity after adversity almost for the last decade. So for it to finally come good after just got to be the most trying period in his professional career, the last three seasons, he must feel like he's been wasting his time. Imagine if that turned around and he was able to deliver a title next season. I think it'd be fantastic. It'd be a brilliant story.
Absolutely. I think the sad anomaly will be, which is much more likely, that he'll retire with two world championships, which I think is just absolutely outrageous and not befitting of his abilities. But yeah, it would be a fantastic reward for him, keeping that motivation that you were talking about earlier, Scott, of still driving as hard as he can and putting out these amazing performances for maybe 10th.
It would be a great way to end, really, wouldn't it? He wants the third world championship. I don't think he's too worried about getting too many more. When he's talking about doing Indy, he said, well, the way to show I'm a great driver would be to win 8 world championships, one more than Michael Schumacher. Well, even he knows that's pretty unlikely. Even the third one is looking a bit of a long shot at the moment. So he said, well, I can't win 8 championships, so I'll have to try and do the Triple Crown. But a third Formula One world championship, if he can get into the car to do it, maybe it'll be a McLaren Honda. Could it be a Renault? That's an interesting question. But I don't think it would be in any way a sad thing. I don't think anyone would look at that gap. I think it would just be, wow, what a journey. Normally the journey to the world championship is from the start of the career to finally realising that dream. But if anything, Alonso's had a whole second journey. It's like it's the sequel, the journey from that second world championship in 2006, where he thought he was going to win 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 world championships, to the point where finally he can win one again. I'd absolutely love to see it.
I think most people would, wouldn't they? Most fans would love it. Just for him to be in the fight, really. And it's easy to forget that if he'd score 11 more championship points at the right time, and he'd be 5-time world champion. And maybe he'd have switched to IndyCar permanently, won the Indy 500 by now, and now be doing Le Mans.
Yep, now he'd be trying to tick off the Bathurst 1000.
Oh.
there was a comment that Button made last year after retiring early from the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, where he kept being asked sort of what it was like to end his career that way. And one of the things Jensen kept saying was that, you know, the result today was never going to change anything for me. I've won a world title, I've won these many races, great career, blah, blah, blah. And I think there was a few people were sort of, even the questions he was being asked was just sort of, you know, do you have any regrets? What do you take home? And he's saying, you know, like I had my chance to win a world title. I took it. I won a few races. Maybe I could have won a few more, but I don't, you know, I have no regrets, that sort of thing. I cannot imagine Alonso saying the same thing when he stops. It just doesn't sit right. There are some people where you just go, right, yeah, you've won a world, like Button, for example, who I personally am a massive fan of. I grew up when I was karting myself, looking up, Button was my first sporting idol. But one world title, I sort of go, yep, that's brilliant. I don't think you were like one of the greatest ever, but you're a driver who I think deserved a crack at the world title, and fair play for you for taking it. Raikkonen, one world title, I'd say in terms of pure ability compared to Button, you know, if someone had said to me 10 years ago or 11 years ago, he's only ever going to win one world title, I'd have said, that's just wrong. And exactly the same as Alonso. Who could have thought at the end of the 2006 season when he was moving to McLaren that was probably going to be the last time he ever was spoken of as the world champion, not a world champion. It just sits really, really oddly with me that someone of Alonso's ability is probably going to end with two titles and nothing more.
But then actually, thinking about it, Jim Clark was only a double world champion. He's still regarded as one of some people say the greatest of all time. And that was circumstances not quite the same, but in an era when reliability hurt you more. I think that, you know, Alonso's done enough that he's going to be considered one of the absolute greats of all time. But yeah, I agree that because of that, two titles doesn't really do him justice.
Well, to butcher a pop culture reference, you know, in this situation for a double Formula One world champion, you either die a hero or you live long enough for people to feel sorry for you that you only won two world titles.
That's a good way of looking at it. And there's always this element of show us your medals, isn't there? You know, I think you'll want to have that third world championship. Puts him up there with Senna. Hamilton always said the third world championship was the big one for him. And I think it is a big deal for Alonso as well. Now, a final question, which is actually a question about autosport. This comes from Lewis Jones.
I'm excited by this one. I saw this earlier and thought, oh, I can't wait to get into this.
Excellent. We're looking forward to a high quality answer then, Scott. Lewis's question is, other than the obvious takeover of the internet as being the tool for sharing news, what are the most apparent and hard challenges facing a traditional news outlet such as yourselves when it comes to adapting to changes in the modern world? Do you look back and wish that autosport was able to run as it did in days of old, or do you embrace the future despite its uncertainty? Now, before I get Scott and Kev on this, I just have to add, I would say we've moved a bit with the times. We've got a successful website, autosport.com, with a paywall model that is necessary for us to operate the website and works well for us. So we've kind of tried to embrace the digital age. So I wouldn't say we are a fully traditional one. We're a traditional news outlet, should we say, by history. But autosport.com's been up and running for almost 20 years now. So I would say that's the first thing. That's one of the big things where we have moved. Had the website not been started all those years ago, which is before the time of any of us in this room, the website was a few years old by the time I joined, I think it would have been very different. But obviously there's a much bigger question there than that. So let's start with Scott. You were very eager. I hope you've prepared a speech.
I would say the most apparent and hard challenge facing being a news outlet these days is maintaining integrity and patience in the face of a completely different working environment to before. The immediacy of the internet in the modern age makes it really, really difficult for some people, most people probably, to just sort of calm down a little bit when there's a big story or you're chasing something that's contentious. On television, for example, where, you know, the news is always on. You don't just have weekly deadlines or monthly deadlines or whatever. You know, you're always live. You're always reacting. And certainly working on autosport.com is like that. You do face a bit of pressure to get news out there as live, but you can't trip over the hurdle of sacrificing quality for speed.
If you can be first, great, but you've got to be right, whatever happens.
You've got to be right, and that's what I mean by maintaining integrity. That's what I love about Autosport, working for Autosport, is it feels like people believe that we have maintained that level of integrity, and it is very difficult. The way we work is as you pointed out, Ed, you've got to be quick, but you've got to be right. And leading into sort of the second half of the question, you know, do I wish it was as it was back in the day, or do I embrace it? I love the challenge of doing that. I want Autosport to be the voice of honesty and clarity at a time when the news feed is clogged up with tweets, with rumor, gossip, or, you know, there is such an important role to play in the media, and this goes beyond just the motorsport media as well. In general, when there's so much, you know, disinformation that is readily available.
I guess the big thing that people always talk about when it comes to the magazine, Kev, is people say, oh, why wasn't it like it was in 1980 when it was much better, etc., etc., etc. You know, I've been editor of the magazine in the past and had exactly the same thing. And I think every autosport editor, actually, going back a long time, has always had the why don't you do it like it was in the past. And obviously we get the discussion about why it's almost universally F1 on the cover, etc., why they want more coverage of XYZ championship, etc. So that's an interesting thing about the changing world and the changing motorsport landscape.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's true. And I would say they're kind of, from the magazine point of view, which I kind of feel like that question is actually sort of directed at the magazine. I think, first of all, yes, obviously, if we didn't have the internet, then the magazine would sell more, because all magazines would sell more without the internet. And, you know, it would be easier to work on, because you wouldn't be, when you had a news story, you would have longer to chase. You wouldn't have that thing of, like Scott was talking about, trying to get it up there accurately but rapidly online. However, it also opens up a huge amount of opportunities. So, for example, we get much more live and relevant data from the website, which can then inform, hopefully to a certain degree, what we should be writing about and what people are interested in. But also, I think that there's a certain level of gratification that comes from, actually, we're doing the same thing. Because if you're doing your proper news chasing, you're speaking to the right people, you're in the paddocks, that's the same job that it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. You're trying to convey what is important, whether it's by the day or by the week. What are the relevant things and interesting things for a motorsport fan? And we've just got more ways of disseminating that information now. So it's difficult for the magazine, but as a brand, I think it's very exciting.
Yeah, the mode of delivery evolves and changes, the taste of the audience change, but it's all about adapting. I always think it's great to be in a moving world. People get very fearful about disruptive technologies in any business, and like everything, this is a business. So I actually think it's really interesting to adapt to the way things change, and I love the understanding we've got of reader habits, etc., the things we've learned from having the website running.
Well, it's also worth remembering that, and this is actually applies to the magazine and motorsport and probably actually life in general, is that the people always say it was better back then, but then is a very non-specific time. It's basically, and it's always different when you start probing.
Autosport magazine was much better under the last editor.
He was brilliant. A brief tenure, but brilliant.
I was just too good. I had to move on to a higher plane.
a lot of people, I mean, I think we're probably, this is true of all of us in this room, is that you get interested in motorsport at a particular age. So that tends to be, I'm a bit weird because I went back for further when I discovered motorsport. But generally, when you're sort of a kid, early teens, you get interested in something, whether it's music, sport, whatever. That's the year you think, yeah, that's when it's really mega. And then anything, as you get older and you learn more and things change, it's not like it used to be. But really what that was just a snapshot of how it was at a particular moment. And it was different for the people growing up 20 years early, and it will be different for the people growing up 20 years later. So, yeah, the changing, the moving with that change is important.
I think we've let everybody see quite enough behind the curtain of autosport. But that was an excellent question, so thanks for that one, Lewis. It's an interesting topic and one we talk about a lot. And while we're talking of curtains, it's probably the time to bring the curtain down on this podcast, which has been an interesting chat. What do we reckon about this readers' questions, Lark? It's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah, I like it. I'd like some more. It's good. Definitely have some more.
More historic racing questions, please. Porsche 917s, that's always good.
Yeah, more Formula E questions.
Or rallycross, because we want to keep Scott happy.
Yeah, let's have some Lyddon Hill questions.
Or butterflies, if Stuart's here. Stuart Codling.
Next time someone needs to ask me what I think about the World Rallycross Championship moving away from Lyddon Hill to Silverstone.
So, that's a good question.
Send me your question on a postcard.
I'm going to make sure if we do talk about rallycross, you're not on that particular podcast.
Can my dad come in for that podcast?
He can come in if he wants.
Excellent. So that's my dad. Watch.
He can't speak. Yeah, exactly. He can come in.
He can watch from the packed viewing gallery.
Hi, Dad.
Anyway, so yeah, if you have any questions, hashtag AskAutosport or tweet us on @Autosport. We'll be happy to try and fit in a few questions. It'll depend on what else is on the agenda, but we're happy to try and tackle topics and specific questions you have. So thanks very much, Kevin Turner, Autosport editor, Scott Mitchell, Autosport Plus editor, and thanks for myself, Ed Straw. Obviously, you can check out Autosport Magazine on Thursday with all the goodies that Kev was talking about earlier on. Check out autosport.com for all the news and latest features. We've got loads of coverage of the Spanish Grand Prix weekend coming up. Subscribe to the podcast as well via iTunes or various other podcast platforms. We're there just about anywhere you could hope to find us. So thanks very much for joining us. We'll be back soon with another Autosport podcast. Music is 6 AM by Trelo, written by Marcus Simmons. See soundcloud.com/Trelo Music.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Sports Social Podcast Network.